Good afternoon, and thank you all for holding. Your lines have been placed on a listen-only mode until the question-and-answer portion of today's conference. I would like to remind all parties the call is now being recorded. If you have any objections, to please disconnect at this time. I would now like to turn the call over to Ms. Alicia Downs. Thank you. You may begin.
Good afternoon, and welcome to today's COCA conference call on the swine influenza investigation. We are very excited to welcome back Dr. Tim Iwicki. Dr. Iwicki is a medical epidemiologist in the influenza division here at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta, Georgia. We will not be using a PowerPoint presentation for this call, and there will be no continuing education credits or contact hours available. I will now turn the call over to Dr. Iwicki.
Thank you. Good afternoon. What I'd like to do is just give you a brief update on the situation, and then try to address a few questions, or anticipate a few questions, and then we'll open it up to questions from the listeners. So first, thank you very much for joining us. One thing I'd like to say at the outset is that this situation is very fluid, very dynamic. It is rapidly evolving. So what I tell you right now is likely to be very different than the situation, you know, later today or tomorrow. In addition, the guidance that we have posted, and we have posted quite a lot of guidance on our web pages, realize that it is interim guidance. And because the situation is so fluid, because it is rapidly evolving, we are clearly focused on putting out guidance, but we are also focused upon revising that guidance given the new information as it develops. And we also really appreciate any feedback from our clinical partners out there. So what we have posted is we have posted information for clinicians about antiviral recommendations. We've also posted information about safety guidance for laboratory workers. We've posted infection control recommendations. We've posted some non-pharmaceutical community mitigation guidance, and we've posted some home care guidance, really for the public in terms of guidance to take care of a sick person who may either be suspected or confirmed at home. So realize that this all of our guidance is interim, and we would suggest that you continue to consult our web pages for the latest information. Now, to date, or at this time, we have 40 confirmed cases of swine influenza virus swine influenza A H1N1 virus infection in the United States, and those cases have been identified in 5 states. The median age is approximately 16 years, with a range from 7 to 54 years of age. A significant proportion of those cases are less than 18 years old, with essentially an equal male-to-female ratio. There is some history of travel to Mexico in some patients. In terms of the secondary attack rate, there are a lot of studies and investigations going on right now to determine that, but in terms of attack rates for influenza-like illness, it appears to be around 18 to 20%. The attack rate, secondary attack rate for influenza-like illness appears to be about 18 to 20%, maybe a little bit higher for any kind of respiratory symptoms. But this is, you know, very early information from some of the investigations that were done on early cases. It's important to realize that there have been no deaths in any of the 40 cases that have been confirmed in the U.S. All of the individuals have had essentially influenza-like illness, uncomplicated influenza-like illness. That would be fever, cough, sore throat, headache, fatigue, generally upper respiratory symptoms, but also some muscle aches, body aches, as well as some gastrointestinal symptoms such as vomiting and diarrhea in some of the patients. And again, all of this fever, cough, runny nose, sore throat, headache, fatigue, muscle aches, vomiting and diarrhea, these are what we have seen with sporadic human cases of swine influenza virus in the past, and actually recent past, in the United States. Now, what's important to realize is that the cases in the United States do not have a link to contact or exposure to pigs, sick pigs or any pigs. This all appears to be ongoing human-to-human transmission. In terms of the international situation, clearly there are countries that with probable cases. There are attempts underway to confirm these probable cases in a number of countries. And I think the expectation is that we will see much more disease in the U.S. We will see other countries that are affected. And in terms of North America, certainly there appears to be a fairly widespread illness in Mexico, as well as some severe disease, which I'll get back to in a second. There are also confirmed swine cases in Canada. Now, as I mentioned, none of the 40 confirmed cases in the U.S. have died. At least my information is that one of the 40 cases has been hospitalized. It's possible that there are others where this is a very fluid situation, and we're looking to try to get you all that information. The case that was hospitalized was not necessarily hospitalized because of influenza-like illness. The case had underlying autoimmune disease and was immunosuppressed and actually had a negative chest x-ray, normal chest x-ray, but had other underlying chronic medical conditions that really were likely involved in her admission. In terms of Mexico, we have a number of CDC people in Mexico trying to work closely with the Mexican health authorities as well as the World Health Organization, Pan American Health Organization in Mexico. What I will say is that clearly there have been reported cases of very severe disease as well as fatal outcomes, and that there are virologically confirmed, so laboratory confirmed fatal cases in Mexico. This virus is a brand new virus. It has never been detected before in North America. And for clinicians, what is important to realize is that this virus is resistant to the antiviral medications amantadine and rimantadine, and therefore those medications are not recommended for treatment of this swine influenza virus infection. The good news is that this virus, swine influenza A H1N1 virus, is sensitive. It is susceptible to the neuraminidase inhibitor medications, zanamivir, that's Relenza, and oseltamivir, that's Tamiflu. So those medications are recommended for treatment and chemoprophylaxis of swine influenza A H1N1 virus infection. And I think what I'm going to do is just stop there and open it up to questions.
Thank you. And at this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your touch-tone phone. And please unmute your phone and record your name clearly when prompted. Your name is required to introduce your question. Once again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1. One moment, please, for the first question. Our first question is from Amish Adulja.
Hi, Dr. Ewek. I had a question regarding the diagnostic, diagnosis of this based on rapid flu tests, and how are these cases being picked up initially in a regular ER with a normal nasal swab? Are those positive, or are they coming up negative, and then are they being sent for backup viral culture, and that's how these things are coming to light?
Right. Thanks for your question. So the way that these confirmed cases are coming to light and are initially these are people seeking medical care. The initial cases were in some sense accidentally discovered. That is, there were patients coming in with uncomplicated influenza-like illness to outpatient clinics, outpatient facilities. And these facilities were initially, for the initial cases, were enrolled in or had protocols, surveillance protocols, in which specimens were collected, upper respiratory tract specimens, nasopharyngeal swabs. In other words, it wasn't because the clinician suspected, there wasn't any clinical decision to obtain the specimen. It was simply because there were the facility was participating in surveillance protocols. And these specimens were tested by real-time RT-PCR using the CDC primer probe set, which detects influenza A, influenza B, and influenza A subtypes H1, H3, and H5. These initial cases, in fact, most of these cases, have been picked up because they're testing positive for influenza A, negative for influenza B, and negative for the subtypes H1, H3, and H5. And so those primers for H1 and H3, those are for human influenza A viruses, seasonal influenza A virus subtypes. So the primer probe set out there, designed by CDC, will detect influenza A, but they're coming up as what we call influenza A non-subtypable. Those are being sent, shipped to CDC for immediate testing, and we have been identifying those as a new swine influenza A H1N1 virus. So the way diagnostic testing, the recommendation is that specimens, upper respiratory tract specimens, should be collected from suspected cases and sent to the state health department for real-time PCR. And those that are A-positive, non-subtypable, are sent to CDC for confirmation. Now, at some point, this is not going to be possible if there is widespread disease. And as you allude to, clinicians will rely upon other kinds of influenza tests, including rapid, commercially available rapid antigen tests, as well as immunofluorescence. Those tests are obviously not specific for this particular virus, and they're not specific. They will not differentiate between seasonal influenza A and swine influenza A H1N1 virus. But the expectation is that because they do detect conserved portions of the influenza A virus proteins, that they would be able to detect the virus, and that means that you would get a positive result, but you wouldn't know for sure that swine influenza A virus. And the reason is that at this time there are still some seasonal influenza A H1N1 and H3N2 virus activity in the United States, so that causes a little bit of confusion. However, this is towards the end of our regular influenza season, and as we see activity to really drop off, and it has declined, a positive influenza A test by other tests such as rapid tests or immunofluorescence does suggest that the patient may have the swine influenza virus infection. And in such a case, such a situation, that patient could be considered as a probable case and empirically treated. And that certainly would be true in communities where there is a fair amount of swine influenza A virus transmission going on. In communities where you still have seasonal influenza A activity and no confirmed cases of swine influenza A H1N1 virus, I'm not sure that would be the appropriate conclusion. But so confirmation is at CDC by real-time PCR, and we have specific diagnostics to detect this new virus.
Do we know how many are positive on rapid have been positive on rapid tests if they've been sent, or how many rapid tests are positive?
So I can't give you that information. Don't have that. I can tell you that of at least one, I think, that's been tested by rapid test was positive, but I think we can't give you a numerator or a denominator. It's obviously information that as we are able to get that information, we'll get that out. Let me just say one other thing. As the Food and Drug Administration, FDA, wanted me to say that as more patients are treated with oseltamivir and zanamivir, that if there are healthcare providers who are taking chemoprophylaxis or patients that experience adverse events, or if there are medication errors associated with the prescribing of these drugs, FDA would like to encourage clinicians to report these events to MedWatch or call the FDA. And the FDA website is www.fda.gov/medwatch. And the FDA phone number is 1-800-FDA-1088. So one thing I'd like to talk about in terms of antiviral treatment is that we have current guidelines, guidance on the web right now that does say for suspected cases, not confirmed, but for suspected cases, we do say to use a combination of oseltamivir and an adamantane drug. What we'd like to do now, and we will be revising this guidance, is that if you have a patient who is suspected to have swine influenza virus infection, if there are cases in your community, certainly if there's a probable case, that we are recommending only treatment, a monotherapy, with either with a neuraminidase inhibitor. That would be either oseltamivir or zanamivir. And the same is true for chemoprophylaxis, either oseltamivir or zanamivir. And we will be revising and posting that guidance hopefully later today or as soon as possible. I can take another question.
Our next question is from Carolyn Feudum.
Yes, I was reading the interim guidance for infection control, and under the infection control of ill persons in a healthcare setting, the paragraph starts out describing airborne precautions, yet two paragraphs down it talks about use of standard droplet and contact. Should we be using standard airborne and contact, or what exactly should we be doing?
We will be revising that guidance and try to clarify that for you. I think right now we're in a situation where clearly this is human-to-human transmission,
mm-hmm.
ongoing. We do not really, there's a lot that we don't know about this virus. We don't completely understand how it's being transmitted. The working assumption is that this virus is being transmitted similarly to how seasonal influenza A and B viruses are transmitted. That is, we believe, primarily through large droplet or small particle droplet nuclei. Now, what we don't know is other modalities potentially for transmission. In addition, some of these patients have had diarrhea and vomiting, and we don't know whether or not there's the potential for the swine influenza A virus to be present in diarrheal stool of infected patients, and whether or not diarrheal stool could pose a transmission risk. But in terms of the airborne precautions, yes, we have recommended N95 respirators. And again, we will try to clarify the guidance and make it consistent. We would appreciate emails and so forth, feedback from the clinical community.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Our next question is from Denise Curtis.
Well, hello. I think you kind of answered my question. The one thing is, what is your probable case definition?
Yeah, thank you.
And then I have another question, and maybe it's in your guidelines, is the Tamiflu is only for contacts, or so is only for cases or for contacts as well?
So we would recommend, clearly, that any confirmed case of swine influenza A virus and H1N1 virus infection be treated with either zanamivir or oseltamivir. So definitely all confirmed cases. I think we are recommending also that probable cases as well as suspect cases. But what should be treated? But let me just say this. In the United States, again, we have 40 confirmed cases to date. Undoubtedly, this will increase. All of these cases have not had severe disease. I would want to repeat that. The U.S. cases have not experienced severe disease. My understanding of the Canadian cases is that they have not experienced severe disease. In other words, cases are having self-limited, generally influenza-like illness and recovering. This is in contrast to the situation in Mexico, where severe disease has been reported, including laboratory-confirmed cases. Fatal cases. So, obviously the concern is treating people who are severely ill. We are not seeing people who are severely ill in the United States. I think that we should not expect that we will only see mild cases. I think there is definitely potential, and we should expect that there will be severe cases. This could function like a severe seasonal epidemic, that is, in which we see exacerbation of underlying chronic disease resulting in hospitalizations for severe complications. There could also be secondary invasive bacterial infections causing very severe disease and potentially fatal outcomes. So I think the situation so far is good in the U.S. that we've seen mild cases, relatively mild cases, and in Canada. However, it does not mean that we will not see severe cases, does not mean that we will not have fatal cases, and the situation in Mexico is very concerning. And so there's a lot of attempts to try to understand what is happening with these severe and fatal cases in Mexico to better characterize them and so forth. And we're obviously, we have people down there working on that, but there's a limitation to the information we have now. So there is, I want everyone to understand that there's sort of a reason why we have proceeded with some caution. And if we look at most influenza seasons, that is seasonal influenza, most people don't get treated. Most people have self-limited influenza-like illness, and they recover without any specific treatment. And most of these confirmed cases in the U.S. have not been treated. They have recovered without treatment. So although we have recommended treatment for all confirmed cases and suspect and probable cases, that may not be possible if there's a widespread a disease in your community in the future. And in terms of case definitions, we have different case definitions that are posted in different guidances. We apologize sincerely that this, to the extent that this has created any confusion. Realize that there are different case definitions for reporting, for surveillance purposes, and also for clinical management purposes. We are working and we have almost finalized some kind of harmonization of these case definitions, and we hope to post those as soon as possible so to avoid some of the confusion. But realize that for clinicians, what they need to know is maybe different than for reporting purposes. We'd also clearly encourage any clinicians who are caring for a probable case or a confirmed case, especially if they're hospitalized, to report that information to the state health department.
Thank you. Our next question is from Mary Ryder.
Thank you. I think you probably have answered my question as well, Doctor, but I think my concern is with the situation in Mexico, should we expect that we would see something similar here?
I think that no one really knows the answer to that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think anyone can predict. I mean, we always say influenza is unpredictable. Obviously, we're very concerned about the situation in Mexico, given the severity of many cases, as well as, clearly there are laboratory-confirmed fatal outcomes. And our understanding is that these have occurred in generally previously well people, but the information is incomplete. We also understand that most of these severe cases have been sort of in the 20 to 59 year range, so they're not necessarily the very young or the very old, but clearly we need more information. So I think that clearly it's worrisome, and it's good that we have had mild cases in the U.S., but I think we need to prepare for the possibility that we could see severe complications with this infection, including exacerbation of chronic illness, including invasive bacterial infection, co-infection, and including progressive disease. Again, we need to know more about the situation in Mexico, but I think at CDC we're taking the situation very very seriously, and we do not want to send out the message that there will only be mild disease. we simply don't know, and we need to be prepared for the potential for severe disease.
Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question is from Bonnie Lane.
Yes, I oversee some correction facilities, and my environmental manager has already put out two of the rather inexpensive HEPA filters in our lobby. I'm afraid this is going to cause more concern or overreacting. Do the cheap filters work at all against this virus?
So I think that's a very good question, and I think what I would do is refer that to some of my other colleagues at CDC. So I think if you could send that inquiry in, or we can respond back to you, either send by email or call in to CDC. I can't answer that question, but you know, we're not looking at this virus as sort of the airborne aerosol transmission, in the sense that there are other airborne viruses such as variola or measles, varicella, and so forth. This is what we're talking about here. Is likely it's close contact, so it's likely a large droplet and a small particle droplet nuclei. We're not talking about the likelihood that viruses is being showered all over you know, rooms and facilities and so forth, but simply we don't know at this stage, and I'm not sure I can answer your question.
Thank you.
And if you send that email to COCA@cdc.gov, COCA@cdc.gov, we'll try to get you an answer.
Our next question is from Robert Lovis.
Hi. In the interview that Dr. Besser gave earlier, he talked about the stockpile of antiviral medicines, one-fourth of that being shipped to the states where there have been confirmed cases, but he also seemed to say that those drugs were sent to other states. And if that's the case, what states other than the outbreak states have received these antiviral medications? And after you answer that, I'd like to ask another question.
So in terms of the situation, as you know, the U.S. government has declared this to be a national public health emergency. And in conjunction with that, CDC has deployed 25% of our antiviral stockpile. And our antiviral stockpile consists of oseltamivir and zanamivir. It also consists of other supplies. But so the process is that states also have some states have stockpiles of antivirals as well, and CDC is in the process of, they have already shipped out some stockpile drug to some states, and they're in the process of shipping it out widely throughout. The priority initially is has been on states with confirmed cases or those along the Mexican border. I can't really comment anything further than that, but this is a national situation, so it's not just one state over another. Sorry, what's your next question?
Yes, what are the trigger points for actually developing a vaccine from the seed stock, so to speak? Trigger points for generating that on a massive scale. But is there a certain number of confirmed cases you'll have to see before you do that?
So there have been active efforts underway to develop candidate seed virus vaccine strains. This has been going on over the week, and there are multiple efforts and multiple strategies that are underway, include the sort of classical reassortment process, another using the reverse genetics process, and the third to develop a live attenuated candidate. So there's a lot of effort being done right now to develop vaccine candidates.
And when would you...
All commenced. All those activities have started.
Isn't there another point where you decide to develop millions and millions of doses?
So obviously those decisions will be addressed, but the first step is to develop the candidate vaccine.
Thank you.
But I think we can look forward to those kinds of decisions. Yeah.
Thank you. Our next question is from Stephen Abstein.
Hi, thank you very much for taking my question. There's a lot of issue now about whether airplane travel should be avoided if it's practical. Are we at a point where such a recommendation can be made? And if a traveler does decide to go, is it wise to recommend that masks be worn on board?
What I would say is I would consult our web pages as we post guidance on these issues. I would also say that we have right now 40 confirmed cases in the U.S. Undoubtedly, there will be more, and undoubtedly that's probably an underestimate of all the cases out there. But we don't have widespread disease and widespread transmission throughout the United States. So I think that CDC and others have not said anything about stopping all air travel. I think in terms of travel advisories, I would say consult our web pages to see if we are going to be posting travel advisories later today, and stay tuned. In addition, on the global situation, I would suggest keeping up with the WHO web pages and also U.S. State Department web pages for travel advisories. In terms of wearing a mask and so forth, I think that my colleagues from the Division of Global Migration and Quarantine will be posting guidance on that. And there is guidance up there right now about face masks, but specifically about plane travel and so forth, I think that will be addressed. But keep in mind, we're not in a situation right now where we have widespread disease in the U.S., because we don't.
Thank you. Our next question is from Doug Richman.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
I have a couple of questions at the San Diego VA here. One is the antigenicity of these glycoproteins. Is there any information about the relationship to the current vaccine, or is there any information regarding the presence of antibodies in people born before the mid-50s?
So thanks, Dr. Richman. Those are great questions. The preliminary data that we have, which is sort of the standard way we would look at this, which is looking at ferret antisera, strongly suggests that this new swine influenza A H1N1 virus is very distinct from circulating and recently circulating human influenza A H1N1 viruses. And so, in other words, based upon that data, which is not the same as clinical effectiveness in a patient who had been either infected in the past with seasonal H1N1 or vaccinated with seasonal vaccine. So we don't know the clinical effectiveness of past infection or vaccination against this, but it appears, at least from the antisera analysis, that there would not be protection. Protection would not be expected. In terms of people who were born a long time ago, who might have antibody, perhaps antibody to even older H1N1 virus strains or so forth, I think we just don't know. It's a very good question, and I think that these are important questions, but we don't know the answer.
Next question, in light of the suggestions of systemic disease and death in young, otherwise healthy people, is there anything known about the sequence of the hemagglutinin? Does it have a basic amino acid tract that would make it amenable to more systemic infection and diarrheal disease, for example?
Yeah, that's a great question. So this is not, to my knowledge, a highly pathogenic, in other words, influenza A virus. It is not like, say, the so-called avian influenza A H5N1 virus, highly pathogenic virus strains that are circulating in poultry and that have infected humans in 15 countries worldwide. So it's not a highly pathogenic virus in that sense, but clearly it is causing disease and has caused severe disease and fatal outcomes in Mexico. Why exactly, we don't know. Our understanding is that the virus in Mexico is identical to the virus in the U.S. and the virus in Canada. So clearly there's a high priority on trying to sort out what is going on with some of these severe cases and fatal cases. But we don't know that at this time.
Thank you. My final question is the late press has had statements about the genetic composition having different swine strains and being an avian gene in the mix. Can you tell us whether this presumably reassortant virus, what genes come from whom?
Yeah, so let me just sort of comment on that briefly without going into a lot of details. So swine influenza A viruses are circulating among pigs in the United States, actually in North America and worldwide. So in the United States, in the pig population, swine influenza is an endemic disease. There are outbreaks all the time, all over, and there is some seasonality to it. What we have seen over the past 2 to 3 years, and frankly, this has been going on for probably some time. There's cases with other viruses in the literature, but the viruses in the pigs have transmitted to people. Let's say over the last 2.5 years prior to this new strain, this new virus, we have seen about 12 cases in humans that we have documented in the last 2.5 years. And people who had some kind of contact with pigs prior to exposure, so it's pig-to-human transmission. And those individuals had upper respiratory tract and some had gastrointestinal tract illness, and the range was generally what we're seeing in the cases so far, uncomplicated influenza-like illness and diarrheal disease, but there were some severe cases as well. Now, those swine viruses that are circulating in the U.S. are what we call triple reassortant viruses, and they have the genes, they bear genes from avian influenza A viruses, human influenza A viruses, and swine influenza A viruses. In other words, these are reassortant viruses that are circulating among pigs in the U.S. and have transmitted to humans. Now, this new swine influenza A H1N1 virus is a new virus. It is distinct from any swine virus that's been identified in the United States. The similarity is that, there are 8 genes of influenza viruses, and 6 of the genes are basically similar or the same as, they're very similar to 6 of the genes in the triple reassortant swine viruses circulating in the U.S. Those are also H1N1 viruses. However, this new swine influenza virus has 2 genes that are distinct, and they are distinct in that they are not coming. They've never been seen in North America. They're most closely related to what we call Eurasian lineage of swine influenza A viruses. So suggest some kind of reassortant event with other swine viruses coming from other parts of the world with this virus that's been circulating in pigs in the U.S. And just want to clarify that the U.S. cases, again, There's no contact with pigs. What we're seeing is ongoing human-to-human transmission with this new virus. So somehow this new virus became transmissible among people.
Thank you. Our next question is from Yvonne Weave.
Hello?
Yes.
My question is when I was reading the guidelines, when it came to doing the swab, the most common thing that they said in the guidelines was to use nasopharyngeal, but the latest one said that you want two swabs and you wanted them oropharyngeal. So I just wanted to make sure what we're supposed to be doing.
Yeah, so we'll try to clarify that. What we are envisioning is that, you know, we're seeing this virus infect humans and being transmitted from person to person. And the assumption is, you know, I'll just qualify again, this is a new virus. There's a lot we need to learn about this virus. The assumption is that it's being transmitted very similarly to how seasonal influenza A and B viruses are transmitted. And we also believe that it infects the upper respiratory tract. Therefore, the recommended clinical specimens are those that are the same for detection of seasonal influenza A or B virus infection of people. So nasopharyngeal swabs are ideal specimens. Aspirate specimens would also be okay. We realize, you know, we can make a recommendation like that, but we also realize that that may not be so practical. There are people that may not be well skilled in collecting a nasopharyngeal swab. There are also people, the patient, an ill patient, may not want a nasopharyngeal swab collected. So although a nasopharyngeal swab is probably the ideal specimen, there are other specimens that probably can detect this virus, and that those would include nasal specimens, nasal swab, nasal aspirate, nasal wash. A throat swab alone, although it may yield this virus and has yielded this virus, for human influenza, seasonal influenza, it's not the optimal specimen. So, again, we will try to clarify this guidance, but I'm not sure that we would want only a throat swab collected alone. I think if you're going to collect a throat swab, it would be really nice to have a nasal swab as well and sort of maximize the potential to detect this virus. So, again, I think nasopharyngeal specimens are optimal, oral pharyngeal less optimal, but better than nothing, nasal better than oral pharyngeal. Combination of oral pharyngeal and nasal would be very good.
And you do want two nasopharyngeal swabs?
Well, I'm not quite sure what guidance you're referring to. We'll try to clarify that, but I think right now, in certainly in areas that have not had confirmed cases of this new swine influenza virus, you kind of want to give your laboratory, state health laboratory, you want to maximize their ability to detect the virus. So, you know, sending more specimens can help in that. There's other information that we need to know. How well do immunofluorescence assays or rapid antigen assays pick this up, and those kind of comparisons need to be made. So we'll try to clarify this guidance.
Thank you.
This is a really evolving situation. If you can imagine, there's a huge amount of effort going on to this. We're trying to do the best we can. We realize that we apologize for any confusion in our guidance. Realize it's interim. We're learning every day, and we really rely upon you and appreciate the clinical feedback so we can get the best guidance out.
Michelle, if we can take one more question. Our next question is from Marcia McGowan. Marcia McGowan, your line is open. Please check your mute feature.
Hi,
hello.
This is Dr. Eason from the Department of Health. How are you?
I
need to have clarification about those nasal pharyngeal swabs. Number one, for children, we do collect the swabs where we use the 3 cc's normal saline.
Yeah, so a wash is what you're...
a wash. What the age recommendation, if we can't get a really good purulent nasal swab, we should do the aspirate for the children, number one, right?
I'll just say this, that, you know, we can make recommendations, and I think that these are only recommendations. And I think certainly states and clinicians, hospitals, are welcome to use our recommendations, adapt them to your use. You know, clearly in young infants, a nasal pharyngeal swab is really, you know, the nasal pharynx is not well developed. So in children, an aspirate or wash specimen for young children is very common for other respiratory viruses, including seasonal influenza viruses. So I'm not sure that we've actually issued age cutoffs or so forth, but bottom line is you want to get some upper respiratory tract specimens, nasopharyngeal or nasal or optimal.
Now that, thank you. And the second question I have is as far as the productive sputum. Now, say if someone does have productive sputum, but we know that we could get a good swab from the nasal and oropharyngeal route, we could just send the nasal and oropharyngeal route, correct?
Yes.
All right, and then we can then defer the throat, the productive sputum specimen.
Yes, and just realize, as all clinicians know, that there are other human respiratory viruses and other pathogens that are circulating among people. Not every case of influenza-like illness is going to be due to this swine virus infection, clearly. And there are also seasonal influenza viruses circulating. So there are many other pathogens that can cause influenza-like illness. And you may want to test for, laboratories may want to test for some of these other more common pathogens at the moment.
Okay, but and so if we can't get anything out of the nose and they only have a productive cough, we then should divert to the sputum. Okay.
I think if you have an epidemiological suspicion that you may have, you know, that swine influenza A virus is quite possible, then you should test for swine influenza virus infection at the state health lab using the CDC primer probe set and send us any non-subtypables. I think we're sort of in the early stage right now. At some point, communities that have lots of disease, if they do in the future, this may not be realistic in terms of testing. But right now, we'd like to know more about the confirmed cases.
Dr. Iwicki, thank you so much for providing our listeners with this timely information. I'd also like to thank our participants for joining us today. If you have any additional questions, please send an email to coca@cdc.gov. That's coca@cdc.gov, and we'll try to get those answers to you as quick as we can, but we appreciate your patience in our replies. The recording of this call and the transcript will be posted to the COCA website at emergency.cdc.gov/COCA within a few hours. We are planning another call later in the week, so please stay tuned for information on that. Please remember to check the CDC swine flu site regularly for any updated information or guidance. That URL is cdc.gov/swineflu. Thanks again for participating, and have a wonderful day.
Thank you, and this concludes today's conference. You may disconnect at this time.
Can I ask you a question? Hello?